Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
An estate tax challenge might not seem like the most compelling case to bring before the United States Supreme Court. Then again, U.S. v. Windsor was no ordinary tax case. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. When Edith Windsor was widowed in 2009, the IRS slapped her with a tax bill of more than $360,000, where most other married people would have paid nothing at all on what they inherited from their spouses. The only thing that made Windsor different was that her inheritance came not from her husband, but from her wife, Thea Spire. She paid the bill at first, but she hired my guest, Roberta Kaplan, who fought with Windsor all the way to the Supreme Court to get that payment refunded, and as it turns out, to get the Defense of Marriage Act barring federal recognition of same-sex marriage ruled unconstitutional. Roberta Kaplan's new book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Robbie, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before Thea Spire's estate was the subject of a national debate, you had a chance to meet her and get to know her a little bit as a client.
Well, not as a client. Let me tell the story.
You were her client, so you were her patient.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre story. So, you know, I first got the call from Edie asking her to represent Edie after Thea had died in late 2009. And when I got that call, I knew immediately, I'd never met Edie, I'd never laid eyes on her, but I knew immediately who she was. And that's not because she is the celebrity, the gay icon that she is today, because she was not back then. It's because almost 20 years before that, I had been in my third year of law school. I think it's fair to say that in terms of coming out of the closet, I was what you would call a late bloomer. I had thought about it certainly in college, and I hadn't done anything. I'd thought about it in law school, and I waited till the very, very bitter end of my third year. And my bad luck, just as I kind of had the courage to come out, my parents were coming to visit me that weekend from Cleveland, where they live and still live. And even worse luck for me, it was Gay Pride. So my parents came over to visit me in my apartment. I had a studio apartment on the Upper West Side, and they kind of had to wend their way through the parade. And by the time they got to my house, I think it's fair to say they were kind of in high dudgeon. My mom and dad start talking about, you know, what's with all the rainbow flags? What are people so proud of, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, you know, please stop. And as mothers and daughters are wont to do, they continued. And then I said, stop again. And then they said, well, why? You know, what's going on with you? Are you saying that you're gay? And I said, yes. And they walked about a foot over to the corner of the apartment, and my mom started banging her head against the wall.
Literally banging her head against the wall.
Quite literally. I mean, people joke now that it sounds like a Seinfeld episode, but it was way before Seinfeld. And it wasn't funny at the time.
Yeah,
I can
laugh
about it now. First of all, let me say this is not about my parents. It's not even a criticism on my parents. My mom has apologized for this probably about 50 million times but at this point. And like so many other people, my parents have moved on this, and they could not be any prouder of me and my family and my life. But at that time, back in 1991, I think it's fair to say I was pretty low. I was in New York City for the rest of the summer. I was moving to Boston in the fall, and I went around asking people for a psychologist who's good at gay issues. That's the way you talked about it back then. And I kept getting the same name. Every time I asked, the name I kept getting was Thea Spire. So the truly incredible, maybe the most incredible thing about this whole story is that I actually saw Thea Spire as a patient 18 years ever before I met her wife, Edie Windsor, and in the very same room when I met Edie, because Thea was already paralyzed. She had very advanced MS, and she saw patients in her living room. And here's probably the most wild part about the whole thing is during those sessions, she talked about Edie. That's how I knew who Edie was. I know, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I think it's kind of unusual for psychologists to talk that way about their own life with their patients. But in retrospect, I think I understand why Thea did it. I think Thea was convinced that the only way – I was so stubborn and so despondent that the only way she thought she could convince me that I could have the kind of life I wanted was to tell me about her own life with Edie Windsor.
Because at the time, you still didn't fully understand that you could have, like, what, and I'm using air quotes here, a normal life and still be a lesbian who was out and comfortable with herself.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I was such a late bloomer in this respect is because I was, you know, very, very worried. I was no campus radical.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone would ever call me a radical about anything. I wanted to have the kind of life that my parents and family had. I just wanted to do it and be gay. And back then, it didn't seem possible.
Thea and Edie were deeply committed to one another long before any government anywhere would grant them the right to marry legally. There's a really moving story about, instead of an engagement ring or a wedding band, the gift that was exchanged.
Yeah, so this was part of the most one of the more incredible parts about this part of the story is that this happened in 1967, which for people out there who may not know this, was 2 years before Stonewall. So 2 years before there even was a modern gay civil rights movement, Edie and Thea had already been dating, and they were very seriously in love. And Thea had said to Edie one day, look, you know, if you showed up at work one day, Edie worked at IBM. She was a very prominent computer software programmer there. And Thea said, if you showed up at IBM one day with a big diamond ring, what would people say? And Edie said, I can't do that. If I show up at IBM with a big diamond ring, everyone's going to say, who's the lucky guy?
Right.
And I can't answer that question, so that's impossible. It turns out, actually, that Edie did get a lot of questions about who is this person, Thea Speier, who you talk to on the phone all the time. And her answer at the time was that she was dating Thea's brother, Willie. It turns out there is a Willie. He is Thea's Dutch wooden doll from Amsterdam. I've seen him. He lives in Edie's closet. But that kind of gives you a sense of how closeted people had to be back at that time. So after this conversation, Thea, they were driving out to the country one weekend. Thea pulled over by the side of the road, and instead of taking out a big diamond ring, took out a circular diamond pin and said to Edie, will you marry me? Incredible. Again, 2 years before Stonewall.
And, of course, they didn't actually marry for decades because there was nowhere for them to do so. What made them decide, after they had made this commitment, to actually go through with a legal ceremony?
Yeah, so as I said before, Thea, about 10 or 15 years into their relationship, was diagnosed with a very terrible form of multiple sclerosis. And over time, she lost the use of her legs and her arms. By the time she died, she was a quadriplegic. And they were kind of waiting for the opportunity to marry in New York, because if you're a quadriplegic, traveling anywhere is incredibly difficult, incredibly uncomfortable and difficult. And they were hoping, actually, that they would get that opportunity in New York, and then it's partially my fault. I argued the New York marriage case in 2006 and lost it. And so then they were still kind of waiting, thinking about going to a neighboring state, and that really wasn't happening either. And Edie said to Thea, do you want to go to Toronto to get married? And Thea said, you know, I will if you want, but I really kind of prefer not to because it's just so hard. And Edie understood that. And then Thea got a horrible diagnosis, a sad diagnosis from her doctors, that she only had about a year or two to live. And the very next morning after getting that diagnosis, she woke up and she said to Edie, do you still want to get married? And Edie said, I do. And they went to Toronto, and a couple weeks later, with four best women and two best men, they needed people who could kind of disassemble and reassemble Thea's electric wheelchair. They got married in the Toronto Airport Hilton, so they could just wheel Thea kind of into where they had the wedding room. If you think about it, I mean, that's a couple who really, really, really wanted to get married.
You write that growing up in Cleveland in the 70s, you didn't realize yet that you would turn out to be gay, but you always knew that you would be a lawyer.
It's true. So when I was a kid, I liked to talk a lot. My uncle was in the Peace Corps. This was during the Vietnam era, and there are these wonderful letters that he has saved that he wrote to my mother and my grandmother and that they wrote back. And in one of those letters, my grandmother recounts the story. I was about 2 and a half, where she said to me, Robbie, like, can you just be quiet for like 2 minutes? Like, do you really have to talk all the time? And I said, oh, but Grandma, I just can't help it. I just love to talk. And at some point, I got the idea, which turns out to be true, that if you're a lawyer, you get paid to talk. So for me, that sounded like the ideal job. And at a pretty young age, I thought that's what I wanted to do.
What did Edie Windsor want to know about you before deciding you were the right attorney to argue her case?
Well, that's a good question. So a couple things. She wasn't so sure at first. So the first thing she said to me is, how much is it going to cost me? And I remember I actually put up a zero. I made a zero sign with my hand and kind of showed her. and told her that Paul Weiss would be happy to do the case, what's called pro bono or for free.
This is your law firm.
This is my law firm. She seemed a little surprised by that and said, no, she really wanted to pay. And I said, no, you know, trust me, she really couldn't possibly afford our fees. Mm-hmm. And that we would be honored to do the case pro bono, which we did, the entire case. And then she said to me, well, how do I know you're qualified? And I said, well, you know what? Let's go over in the corner of her living room. She has a big Apple computer. And I played on the computer. They're still on. I think it's still available on YouTube. The video of my argument in the New York Court of Appeals in 2006, the case I lost. And I said, why don't you watch this for a while? And she watched it. And then she has said later that she thought that it took so much integrity for me to use that as an example, a case I lost, as a qualification to do this case, that she was immediately certain that I was the right person to do this.
You were not the first attorney that she'd contacted. Can you talk about where she had started her search for legal help?
Yeah. So, you know, there's this wonderful documentary that was made about Edie and Thea really in the last couple of years of Thea's life called Edie and Thea, A Very Long Engagement. I highly recommend it to anyone. And Edie believed that as a result, I mean, it's almost incredible now, that as a result of this documentary, she had a documented marriage. I mean, again, I don't think any gay person today would think that you needed a documentary to be made about you, right, to show that you were married. But that's what she had, and she thought it was very important. And so after Thea died, when she realized she had to pay this enormous estate tax bill, a bill that she said she felt indignant about, she went around and asked for a lawyer. And she basically said to them, look, I have this documented marriage. I'm the perfect case. You should let me sue. I want to get my money back. And she was turned down. Now, I wasn't a party to those conversations, so I it's hearsay from my perspective. But I'm told that she was told things like, it's not the right time. I suspect there was a concern that she wasn't the right kind of a plaintiff. I suspect there was a concern that they wanted more than one plaintiff. It's very unusual to do a major gay rights case with only one plaintiff. I suspect that that was behind it. But again, I wasn't a party to those conversations.
What would have made her not the right kind of plaintiff?
Well, that's one thing I do know a little bit about because I heard it myself. And there was a sense that Edie would be perceived as kind of this privileged white lady, mm-hmm. For lack of a better term. The fact that she had to pay such a high tax bill means, which is true, that she obviously had resources. Most of the tax bill was due to appreciation in their Manhattan apartment, which they bought in like the late 70s, and obviously it appreciated greatly in value. But there was concern that Americans wouldn't get her story because they would see her as kind of this rich, rich old lady. That didn't bother me at all. First of all, Americans, I think no Americans ever want to pay taxes, period. We all get in our gut, I think, what it would mean to have to pay a tax simply because you're gay. Two, you know, I've been studying the Revolutionary War with my son, and call me crazy, but I think our country kind of started because of a fight about unfair taxes. So that helps. Three, the Republican Party doesn't even like the estate tax. So I thought that was great because here she had to pay a tax that they don't even want. And then I thought, you know, putting all that stuff aside, I just thought her story, the 44 years with Thea Spire, truly a marriage in sickness and in health till death did them part. I thought any American would be able to get that. So I thought it was the perfect case in so many ways.
My guest is Roberta Kaplan, the attorney who argued U.S. v. Windsor before the Supreme Court. We're talking about her new book, Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
Because of today's Supreme Court ruling, the federal government can no longer discriminate against the marriages of gay and lesbian Americans. Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA. And those same children who happen to be gay will be free to love and get married, as Thea and I did, but with the same federal benefits, protections, and dignity as everyone else. If I had to survive Thea, what a glorious way to do it. And she would be so pleased. Thank you all.
That is Edie Windsor in 2013, after the Supreme Court ruling that overturned the Defense of Marriage Act. We're speaking this hour with the attorney who argued that case all the way to the Supreme Court, Roberta Kaplan. Her new book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Robbie, when you were pulling this case together, first to go through the lower courts, you didn't know for certain that this would be argued before the Supreme Court. There's like a couple of different approaches you can take, I guess, right? You can look at this all the time thinking this will be the test case that overturns the Defense of Marriage Act, or you can say, I'm going to get this nice old widow her tax money back that she is owed. Can you talk a little bit about the way that you had to sort of balance your approach in arguing this case?
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, I was very, very much in the latter camp. Mm-hmm. You know, this is my client and I'm going to get her money back. In part because that's kind of, no pun intended, but that's my orientation in the sense that as a trial lawyer working here in New York City for many years, I believe that my utmost duty in any case is to represent my client and their interests. And that's what I need to think about. So, we actually had this post-it that I put on my laptop when I was working kind of the most intense part of the case where it said, it's all about Edie stupid, borrowing from the first Clinton campaign. And I really believe that. I mean, I think we all understood at the outset that a case would get to the Supreme Court, but we certainly didn't know it was going to be our case and that our job in the meantime was to get Edie her money back. And in a lot of ways, I think that made things much easier for us because while we certainly took counsel from all kinds of interested groups and, we sat in on interminable conference calls and phone calls throughout the whole case, in the end, when we were making a decision about what to do or not to do, the sole criteria was, is it going to help Edie get her money back? And that had a kind of purifying impact, I think, that all enabled us to think much more clearly about things.
I don't know if you wrote the bio on the Paul Weiss website or if that was your marketing folks, but it describes you as both a litigation superstar and a pressure junkie.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So just talk to anyone who knows me or anyone in my family. Maybe it wasn't just the fact that I liked to talk so much as a kid. I think I probably somewhere instinctually knew that I liked being under pressure. There is no doubt that I found the right profession for myself. Because as lawyers who appear in court and argue cases in any court, doesn't have to be at the Supreme Court, you're often up against a lot of pressure. And for me, I think it kind of is motivating. So even at the toughest times of the case, at the early part of the case, for example, when we first filed the complaint, or later when I realized I was actually going to argue this, my first case ever in the Supreme Court. I actually think that ended up motivating me probably much more than anyone else. I kind of thrive under pressure.
You write that because this was the first case you had argued before the Supreme Court, everybody came out of the woodwork to offer you advice. One attorney adamantly suggested that you needed to de-gay the case. First of all, explain what that means and then explain why that might have been a strategy.
Yeah, so the concern was, and it's certainly understandable, the concern was that the Supreme Court was not yet ready to embrace gay rights in the way that it was would have had to do in order for us to win the case. And that, therefore, the better way for us to win the case is rather than stressing the prior decisions, there were really only two at that point, the prior Supreme Court decisions, Romer and Lawrence, that really relied on the rights of gay people, that we should focus instead on some other cases that dealt with other groups. One of them, as I recall, is called Moreno. It deals with hippies, essentially. And another one is called Claiborne, and it deals with people who are mentally disabled. And our view, I think, at the time was, number one, Justice Kennedy, who in cases like this is the deciding vote, he said recently that he doesn't swing cases due. But regardless of how you want to put it, his vote is the vote that counts. And so we thought that given that he had already written the two prior gay rights decisions, that he seemed open to this idea that gay people should be treated with the same dignity as everyone else and that we really should focus on that. Secondarily, I'm not sure we had a choice. I don't think we could de-gay Edie Windsor if we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
That's who she is. That's what the case truly was about. It's about her and her wife's equal dignity as gay people. And we thought that if we could persuade the justices that the marriage that Edie and Thea had was not unlike any of their own marriages, you know, and Justice Ginsburg had lost her husband a couple years before that, then we would win the case. Because if we could prove that, then there was really no argument for why it was okay to treat Edie so differently just because she'd been married to a woman.
I would imagine that it's both an amazing and suddenly a terrifying day when the Supreme Court announces that it will hear a case that you've been working on.
I agree with both of those things. So we were actually, the Supreme Court has this thing where they conference or they meet about cases and they try to decide which cases they're going to take and in what form they're going to take and what the questions are going to be. And as I recall, they did that in both our case and in the Prop 8 cases out of California on several occasions before they actually announced. So there were four or five kind of false starts. And then when the court announced, we were all in a conference room at Paul Weiss. I remember we got champagne. I got Edie's allergic to champagne, so we got her some vodka. There was a lot of cheering in the conference room. I made two calls immediately. I made one to my co-counsel, Pam Carlin, at Stanford Law School, and I told her that she better get ready to get her hair blown out for the argument day in D.C. And then I made a call to Mary Bonato, who had really been the Thurgood Marshall of our movement in so many ways, who'd argued both the Vermont case, the Massachusetts case, and then argued Obergefell earlier this year. And I asked Mary if she would come on board and help us work on the amicus briefs that we knew would be needed for the Supreme Court.
Side note, of course, you mentioned Obergefell, and Vic Holmes and Mark Ferris were married just this weekend.
Yes, I've been avidly following all the photos.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched the photos. I've watched the dance videos. I saw the huge wedding cake that they had. I am so sorry. We had hoped to go, but it was just my son isn't feeling well. I think I'm coming down with a cold, so we decided not to risk it. But that looked like quite a Texas-sized celebration, and it should have been. It was totally justified.
When you are preparing your case for the Supreme Court, how is it different than what you've done before the lower courts?
You know, in some respects it's same, and in other respects it's different. I think the main difference is that, first of all, you don't have that much time in the Supreme Court. In my case, I had to share my time with the Solicitor General. So he got 15 minutes, Don Verrilli, and I got 15 minutes. And on top of that, in a case like this, you have to assume that the justices' minds are pretty much made up before they get out on the bench. You're not really going to have either the time or, frankly, it's the right atmosphere to kind of persuade a judge to kind of change his or her mind on that bench. So as a result, your job is really to kind of help the justices who are on your side of the case kind of argue and lobby even in some respects with the justices on the other. And again, in a case like this, you know, I shouldn't have said it's all about Edie. I should have said it's all about Kennedy. Because Justice Kennedy's vote is so vitally important in terms of deciding which way the case will go.
You went to Nina Totenberg for fashion advice.
I did. So Pam Carlin, who I mentioned, is very close friends with Nina going back many years. And we had gone to D.C. early. I was up there about 2 weeks early before the argument. And I was, you know how when you're nervous and stressed and you're under a bright light like this, you kind of obsess about minutiae, minor details. And so I was, of course, obsessed about which shoes I should wear. So Pam said she had the perfect idea because she always goes fashion shopping with Nina. So she would invite Nina over. We would have tea in my hotel room, which we did. And then I said to Nina, I laid out my suit that I was going to wear at the Supreme Court on the bed. And then I said to Nina, what shoes should I wear? And Nina said, are you crazy? They're not going to be able to see your feet anyway. She said, you can wear either pair of shoes, it will make no difference. As per usual, she was absolutely right.
She talked about your shoes in her reporting on that day.
She did. She reported to the American public that I ultimately made the very serious decision of going with the Ferragamos. I'm so glad that that will be part of the historical record right now.
On a more serious note, with that 15 minutes that you have, I have to imagine that a speech like that is written and rewritten and edited multiple times. How did you know you had exactly what you wanted to say?
Yeah, well, first of all, your speech, the extent any part of the speech, you have about 20 seconds for that. So you know you have about 20 seconds to begin with before the judges and the justices start interrupting you.
With questions.
And that part of it you obsess on. I mean, we rewrote what's called my opening, you know, hundreds of times probably. And then the rest of it, you know, you're just going to be answering their questions. And the way to practice for that is you just have to practice, which from my perspective meant doing these things called moot courts, where you go in a room and you have eight people or nine people who pretend they're the Supreme Court justices. And their job is to spend 45 minutes beating the living you-know-what out of you, asking you questions. Everyone always wants to play Justice Scalia, but asking you questions like they're on the court. And then here comes the really fun part. When you're done with that, they then spend about another hour critiquing every word you just said. You know, maybe root canal without anesthesia would be more painful, but I'm not so sure of that. I mean, it's tough. And we did a lot of that. We did about eight or nine formal moots, and then we did dozens of informal moots where we just sat around in a conference room and people did the same thing.
What did you learn through that process that maybe wasn't evident to you at the start?
That's an excellent question. Look, I think I learned a couple of things. I already knew it, but I was more convinced than ever at the end of the process that the case was all about, it's all about Edie Stupid, and that I had to keep Edie's interests and Edie's story in the front of my mind at all times. There's a story I tell in the book during one of these kind of informal moot courts where we were kind of debating a complicated issue of constitutional law. And I was really tired. It was late at night. I was frustrated. And we were talking about comparing the rights of gay people to the rights of handicapped people. And I made a terribly flippant remark and said, if I get that question, I'm just going to throw the handicapped people under the bus. And immediately after I said it, I knew what I'd said. After all, Thea had been in a wheelchair for many years. Mm. Edie looked at me. She was not a happy camper. I apologized immediately, and I still feel bad about it to this day. But I think it was a great lesson for me in a way that my job and our job in this case was always to think about Edie and always to think about her dignity and the dignity of Thea, and that if we did that and we did it well enough that we would win the case.
So Edie and Thea were married in Canada and not in New York, but that's where they lived. And by the time this case was coming before the Supreme Court, New York, of course, allowed same-sex couples to marry. This was an element in the way you chose to pursue the case, and it was one that was a little bit controversial with some members of the LGBT community and the gay rights community, which is beyond LGBT individuals themselves. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, there was a sense at the beginning, I mean, it wasn't an ideal set of facts at the beginning that Edie and Thea had to go to Toronto to get married and were not married in their own home state. Obviously, they didn't have a choice. Thea died before 2011, which is when the New York legislature enacted marriage equality here in New York. New York has a kind of a policy, it's called a common law rule, essentially, that says that it will accept marriages from out of state as long as the marriage is not abhorrent, is the word that's used, abhorrent to New York public policy. And because New York at that point had already passed protections for gay couples, it was my view that the New York courts would recognize Edie and Thea's marriage. And in fact, that's what all the judges in the case concluded. But I can tell you, it would be wrong. I wouldn't be totally honest if I told you that I wasn't very relieved in 2011 when Governor Cuomo and others, including my very dear friend Emily Giske, got that bill passed in the New York legislature, because it sure made my case a hell of a lot easier.
Your own wife is thankfully alive and well, but I wonder how much you felt like you were also fighting for your own rights in pursuing this case.
So, you know, in retrospect, this isn't something I was aware of at the time, but in retrospect, I think I actually had an ulterior motive for that post-it. It's all about Edie post-it. And that is, part of me thinks that I was actually kind of trying to remind myself that my duty as a lawyer was to kind of put my own stuff aside. That even though I was a lesbian married who was being adversely impacted by DOMA, that that was not my role to think about that, and I kind of had to push that underground and worry and think only about Edie. And again, that's true for any case, any client, and I think I, for the most part, I managed to do that. There were a couple of times, I think, when the Robbie Kaplan stuff just kind of seeped up out of the cracks. I couldn't hold it down anymore. The most prominent, I think, was during the oral argument at the end, when I was really challenged by the Chief Justice about what had changed and whether it was politicians who were leading the fight and the change in American attitudes or whether it was something else. And in answering one of his questions, if you can hear it on the audio tape, my voice cracks. And every time I listen to that, I think to myself, that's the Robbie Kaplan bubbling up. I just couldn't hold it down anymore.
What was your answer?
And I had explained to him that, in my view, it wasn't Americans following politicians. I think his question was, aren't politicians falling over themselves to support your side of the case? That it wasn't Americans following politicians, but exactly the opposite. What had happened in this country was a shift from a moral disapproval of gay people in 1996, which is what the House report says when they passed DOMA, to a moral understanding in 2013 that gay people are no different than anyone else.
I don't think
it was lost on the court that I was the first gay person to stand up in 2 days of arguments to make that point.
We're speaking this hour with Roberta Kaplan, the attorney who argued U.S. v. Windsor before the Supreme Court. She has a new book out called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with attorney Roberta Kaplan, who argued U.S. v. Windsor before the Supreme Court and is author of a new book called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Robbie, what is the night before your first arguments before the Supreme Court like?
That's a good question. So I would not say it was the most relaxing evening of my life. I read a bunch of, well, actually, interestingly, late that afternoon, we'd been preparing at Paul Weiss, and we kind of all decided that we were ready. And so I left the Paul Weiss office in D.C. and went back to the hotel. And when I kind of walked into the lobby, my son was there. And we had been staying, I had been staying in a separate hotel room from the rest of my family, in part because I was so crazed I didn't want any distractions.
Right.
But in retrospect, you know, I think that was odd for my son. He was then 6 years old, and he'd never been anywhere where his parents had stayed separately in separate hotel rooms. And so he came up running to me, and I was on a phone call, and I kind of signaled with my arm that he needed to wait. And it was not the best thing I've ever done. He got very upset. And I got a call from my wife a few minutes later that said I needed to come deal with this, that he was very, very distraught, very upset, crying, and I needed to come deal with it. And I said, oh, I just need some time to read some more cases. And she said, nope, you're going to come right now. And I went to their room, and he was very upset. He was in the bathroom. I'll never forget this, kind of crouched under the bathroom sink. And I said to him, okay, you know, I'm so sorry about what I did. How about if we go to my hotel room, we all go together, and we watch cartoons and have milk and cookies. And My son's a good negotiator, but he was willing to take that deal. And so we went to my room. I think we watched, it was either Johnny Test or SpongeBob. I can't remember. But we had milk and cookies on my bed, and he calmed down. In retrospect, I had so prepared so hard for this argument for so long that it was probably the best thing that I could do to prepare for it at that point, because reading another case probably wasn't going to do me any good.
Yeah.
But that's what I did. So that's what I did kind of late afternoon. And then I had an early supper, and I have to admit I took two NyQuil to go to sleep that night. And then I woke up early the next morning and was ready.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Bruce in Grand Prairie. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering, when Ms. Kaplan goes in front of the Supreme Court to argue her case, she knows the judicial leanings of the justices, and I assume that she's going there to try to convince them all of her case. But does she also maybe tailor her arguments or points to address both the originalist and a living constitution point of view? Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I think none of us were really of the view that a very strict originalist, and just so the listeners know, an originalist interpretation or originalist view of constitutional interpretation, and I'm simplifying a little bit, but is basically the idea that cases should be interpreted in 2013 or 2015 based on what we understand the founders would have thought when they ratified the Constitution. And there are justices on the court. Justice Scalia is the most prominent of them who believe very strongly in that view. There are others who take a more, I would say more, as your listener said, an approach that the Constitution is a living document and needs to be interpreted more in accordance with the times. I think we were probably of the view that Justice Scalia was not going to vote our way. He had dissented very strongly in both the Lawrence and Romer cases. And he continued to do so both through Windsor and Obergefell. We certainly approach the idea that the Constitution, that the language in the Constitution, equal protection and due process, are vague terms. And they're deliberately vague terms. In our view, they're vague because the people who wrote them knew that the world would change and that times would change. Justice Kennedy expressed that thought, I think, most beautifully in his opinion in Lawrence, which is a case out of Texas, in 2003, when he said that times can blind us to certain truths. So that was really the approach that we took, because obviously, back at the beginning of this country, most Americans probably knew someone who was gay, but they had no idea they knew anyone who was gay, right? Because anyone who was gay back then lived completely in the closet. You had to. You would be killed otherwise. So we knew that a strictly originalist interpretation wouldn't work for our purposes.
We haven't talked about this yet, but it's really a thread throughout the book, and I take it throughout your professional life. Can you talk a little bit about how your religious faith and the principles of your faith have informed your work over the course of your career?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I was no kind of campus radical when I was young. I grew up in a very kind of traditional Jewish community. My community and my religion was and is very, very important to me. Rachel and I were married in a observant Jewish ceremony by my friend, the Rabbi Jan Erbach. And, you know, my religion teaches me, and look, we have separation of church and state, so it's not really an issue for the Supreme Court. But I was very kind of focused on the fact that we should not cede the religious arguments to the other side here. That while there are many religious people in this country who don't think that gay people should have equal rights, there are many religious people in this country who think that we should. And that many people's religions believe that every human being was created in the divine image. And if you believe that, then you believe that every human being has dignity. And if you believe that, then I think you have to agree with me that everyone's dignity needs to be respected under the law. And that's what this issue is really all about.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we have Matt on the line in Dallas. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Chris. Great show. I just wanted to ask your guest, you just mentioned religion. You know, now that marriage equality has basically kind of been, you know, the issue's been settled, the new battleground seems to be on grounds of religious liberty, and you saw what happened in Houston. The ordinance there was defeated. They had a big petition, you know, in a city nearby Dallas. That was, fortunately, that did not succeed. But I wanted to ask you, do you see that going forward, you know, people, whether it's the florist or a baker or an employer, do you see that new battle happening in the courts and maybe getting to the Supreme Court?
Thanks, Durval.
Well, yeah, so first of all, let me say one thing. You know, the Kim Davis debate, when it comes to a public servant, which is what Kim Davis is, I think that debate has also been won and is over. No public servant can decide that they're going to either follow or not follow a particular provision of the Constitution because of their own religious beliefs. Kim Davis lost before every single judge who heard her case. Justice Kennedy recently at Harvard said that while he has great respect for her religious views, that if she wants to follow them, then she can't have her job. She needs to resign. And I think that's well settled. I think the trickier part, and it's what you allude to, is what do you do about private employers or private businesses where you have someone who essentially wants to reestablish Jim Crow for gay people based on supposedly religious beliefs. And there I think the answer is in part not a legal answer. I think it's part a business answer, which is most American, certainly no public company, and most big successful businesses in America have no desire. This is the last fight they want. They do not want a store manager at one of their stores to have the discretion to kick out a customer because he or she is gay, or to tell a little girl that she can't buy that toy because she has two dads. I mean, that's a nightmare for American business. And one of the most effective groups in fighting these legislation, these bills that people have attempted to pass, has actually been the business community, not the gay community, the business community. But as you noted, there is going to be kind of these one-offs, a bakery owner, a sole proprietor, or something like that, Hobby Lobby, which was a privately held company, where the owners say that their religious beliefs prevent them from treating gay people like everyone else. And the real question seems to me is sooner or later the Supreme Court's going to have to decide it. What I'm not sure about is whether it's going to come up in the context of gay rights or more likely may come up in the context of when you already see this in terms of contraception and women's reproductive health. They have a case this term that raises similar questions.
Robbie, I'm really curious what you think about the old saw that says you cannot legislate morality. On the one hand, you know, there may be people who say you can't legislate morality, therefore you can't make, if you disapprove of same-sex couples, you can't, you know, make them not fall in love and be together. On the other hand, if you think that same-sex couples deserve not just legal recognition, but also acceptance by the general population, you can't legislate that either.
Oh, you certainly can't legislate people's beliefs. There's no question about that. But the government, under our constitutional system, which respects and honors these principles of equal protection and due process, has to treat everyone fundamentally the same. And yeah, of course, you know, people who commit murders, you can get rid of their liberty and put them in prison. No one has any issue with that. That's because they've committed a murder. But no one has come up with any argument that allowing gay people to be married and allowing their dignity to be respected under the law hurts anyone. It doesn't. In fact, not only does it not hurt anyone, but everyone agrees that it only helps the gay people and their families and their children in so many, many ways. So while morality, you know, is certainly important, there has to be a reason for the moral issue. And with respect to gay people, there's just no reason, no good reason that's ever been articulated for why gay people should be treated as second class.
It's been a long time since Roe v. Wade. Good people continue to argue on both sides about the abortion question. On the other hand, good people don't seem to be arguing in support of laws that would keep people of different races from marrying. Do you think that marriage rights for same-sex couples are something that will not be argued about much in the future?
I don't think they will, as long as one thing stays the same, and that is as long as people stay out of the closet, as long as people keep coming out of the closet, As long as it remains the case, as it is today, that virtually every American knows a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, a family member who's gay, then I don't think that we're going back. Because once you know and love someone who's gay or just work with someone who's gay, then it's very, very hard to accept the idea that they can be treated and discriminated against solely because of who they are. So I think it's much more like the anti-miscegenation laws in that respect. Abortion, for a whole bunch of complicated reasons, is something that people don't come out about. But as long as gay people continue to live openly, I don't think we're going back.
Your little boy is now, what, 8 or so?
Nine.
Nine, okay. He, it would seem, has probably grown up in a world where his mom's marriage doesn't seem unusual at all to him.
No, I mean, one of my favorite stories is shortly after we won the Windsor case, my son's obsessed with movies, so we decided to have a family movie night. But I kind of put my foot down and I said, I just can't do another Disney cartoon. You're going to have to let me pick the movie, which he, I can't believe it, but he agreed. And we watched My Fair Lady. Hmm. And he loved the movie. But at the end, he said, listen, he said, I got a question. And we said, what's that? And he said, I guess this was an old-fashioned movie. And we said, yeah, it's this old-fashioned. We said, why do you ask? And he says, well, I guess that movie was made before men could marry men.
Hmm.
And, you know, it took a couple seconds for it to dawn on my wife and I what he meant. But in my son's worldview, something's old-fashioned if it happened before men could marry men. That's probably the best thing we ever could have accomplished in this case. And I know that it's something Edie could not, who's very close to my son, could not be more proud of.
How's she doing today?
She's great. She's 86. We should all be 86 like Edie Windsor. She's got a full schedule. We've already been talking about what we're having for dinner on Thanksgiving because she's coming over and what presents she's bringing for my son. So she's doing really wonderful, and she's truly become a part of our family in every sense of the word.
Was she excited about the prospect of you writing a book?
Yeah, I mean, she, you know, I care very deeply about her, and I care very deeply about my relationship with my clients. So I made it very clear to her that anything in the book about her story and about her, she would have input on, and she did. I think she's been thrilled with it so far. I mean, she loves going to book signings. She loves hearing from people. She has signed a lot of copies. She's asked me to sign a lot of copies. She's having a great time with it.
Roberta Kaplan is a litigation partner with Paul Weiss, and she is the attorney who argued for Edie Windsor's case before the Supreme Court in U.S. v. Windsor. Her new book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Robbie, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you so much. Really fun time.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.